This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Imagine walking through a cinnamon forest. It sounds like a stop on the old Candyland board game I played as a kid. But cinnamon is actually the bark of a tree, so cinnamon groves must exist. Vanilla pods hang down like green beans from tall vines, and saffron has at times cost as much as gold. The United States, as we know it, owes a lot to the exploration spurred on by the spice trade, a trade that continues in a somewhat different fashion today. Shelburne resident Hank Kastner was a spice buyer for McCormick & Company, the world's largest spice company. He did that for 33 years, and he joins us today to share his knowledge of spices and to tell us some of the fascinating biology and economics behind the spices that we take for granted every day. Hank, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thanks so much.
So I understand your favorite spice is vanilla, and you're kind of an expert on vanilla, too. Is that true?
Oh, I've been called the king of vanilla, whatever that means. Yes, I think it is probably my favorite one, maybe followed by cinnamon.
And king of vanilla, in this case, a compliment. Not that you're bland and boring.
I hope so, no.
So when people say, oh, that's a vanilla thing, meaning, you know, degrading vanilla by saying, bland, boring, you must take umbrage.
There's no doubt about it. Vanilla is the most complex and most wonderful flavor in the world. So anybody that thinks otherwise just doesn't know what they're talking about.
Why? Why is it so? What's so complex about it? Get us into the idea.
A member of the orchid family. There are 40,000 orchid species in the world. There's only one of any commercial importance. It grows in eastern Mexico. It was discovered by Hernan Cortez when he went to have lunch, or he was entertained by Montezuma at the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan. He was given vanilla in a golden goblet, took it back to Europe, became very, very popular, but very, very expensive.
When we think of chocolate, cocoa, you know, him having that Mexican hot chocolate, but really vanilla is what he brought back.
Exactly. Almost every chocolate recipe that you see has vanilla in it. So It was a combination of both that Cortez was offered by Montezuma. Hopefully he didn't get Montezuma's revenge by having that combination.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yes.
So in Mexico, I mean, we think now often of vanilla. When you go to buy it, people say, well, you're buying Tahitian vanilla or vanilla from Madagascar. So that's where I think of vanilla.
Exactly.
But you're saying Mexico here.
Native to Mexico, but it was taken to Madagascar about 150 years ago after the secret of the hand pollination of the flower was discovered in the mid-1800s. Madagascar is a major supplier today of bourbon vanilla, which is from the Bourbon Islands of Madagascar. Tahitian vanilla is a different species. It comes from the French islands of Tahiti. It's a very, very wonderful, different flavor, but very much more expensive than the Madagascar, so you don't see it very often.
What's the difference in flavor? Can you describe it?
I would say the Tahitian is more fruity. If you have that in an ice cream or in a flan or a creme brulee, it's a very, very wonderful sort of a fruity flavor that's very different than the Madagascar vanilla.
Did you bring vanilla with you, I hear?
I did, yes. I thought maybe I'd bring some in case you weren't sure exactly what it looked like in the bean form. As I mentioned before, it's an orchid species, a beautiful orchid flower that comes out that is hand-pollinated. The green beans that you described at the beginning of the show have to be cured. It's a sun-curing process. It takes 3 or 4 months, and those green beans become sort of dried brown string beans, and at that point they develop the flavor that's so memorable to all of us.
Well, pull it out. I want to see them, and I want to be able to smell as we're having this discussion. I know that's sort of unfair to everybody else who's listening on the radio, but I want to be able to smell the vanilla beans.
Oh, well, the unfortunate thing is you can't see them either on the radio.
I know. But I think people can picture the beans. Now, at least, you can buy them in the grocery store
exactly. In
bean form, which maybe you couldn't before. Maybe people were just expecting a vanilla extract.
Yeah, 99% of the vanilla flavor in the United States is from the extract, but the French and the other people in Europe especially use the bean in their recipes. And it's a very, very wonderful smell or odor or aroma. As I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for vanilla. I mean, this is a wonderful smell, but it is almost more pungent, more, in a way, a little bit more raisin-like than if you opened a bottle of vanilla extract.
Yeah, very, very true. I would say that maybe a pruney smell is what we say in the trade, but raisin, pruney, certainly, they're very, very similar.
I'm on the right track anyway.
Exactly, yeah, there's no doubt about it. Vanilla extract, of course, is 35% alcohol, so you get some alcohol flavor in punch from also the vanilla extract.
Yeah, I at least had the experience as a child, and I think probably many people have of smelling a bottle of vanilla extract and thinking that must be the most wonderful tasting thing imaginable. And then as a small child, you take a swig of it and it's awful.
Yeah, that's right.
How much vanilla needs to be in vanilla extract?
Vanilla extract is actually the standard of identity is set by the Food and Drug Administration. And it's 13.35 ounces of vanilla beans that make 1 gallon of extract. So it's a very, very uniform and predictable flavor strength that you get out of your vanilla extract.
And that's mostly vanilla from Madagascar, not the Tahitian
vanilla? Yeah, probably
vanilla?
99% is actually from Madagascar. Exactly.
We're talking today about spices. We're talking with Hank Kastner, who was kind of the expert on vanilla for McCormick & Company, the largest spice company in the world. He has procured spices from all around the world, made hundreds of trips, and he's with us today sharing his knowledge. So listeners, if you have a question about where your cumin, cardamom, coriander, anything else in your spice cupboard comes from, if you want to know about the biology behind it, if you want to talk economics of spices, now's the time to call in. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Before we leave vanilla, Hank, I want you to double back and talk a little bit about this pollination that you were talking about. You mentioned that vanilla first left Mexico once the secret of pollination was discovered. So describe how it's pollinated in the wild or naturally, and then how it's done for economic and marketing, not marketing, but commercial purposes.
Exactly. It's a wonderful orchid flower that has the male and the female parts in the same flower, but separated by a membrane. In the rainforest of eastern Mexico, a hummingbird or a species of bee called the melipone bee would do that pollination, but it would be haphazard and wouldn't be economically feasible for getting a crop. So the Totonac Indians that were living there in eastern Mexico developed the hand pollination with a sharp stick to remove that membrane, press the male and the female parts, and there was a vanilla bean. When vanilla was taken by the early explorers back to Europe and then to other tropical countries, it was a beautiful flower, but it never produced beans because they didn't realize that the flower had to be hand-pollinated, that there were no natural pollinators elsewhere. So it was only in about 1840 that a slave on Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean near Madagascar discovered that the flower could be pollinated by hand. The Totonacs had that secret for 250 years, but kept it, and they kept the supply of vanilla out of Mexico. But about 150 years ago, it went to the Indian Ocean, and Madagascar is where most of it comes from.
And it's still hand-pollinated today?
Yes, every flower is hand-pollinated today. Very, very labor-intensive in the curing process. It takes 3 months. The vanilla beans are put out in the sun every morning, wrapped up in blankets late in the afternoon, and take it back inside to remain the heat, and that produces the chemical vanillin and many other chemicals that give vanilla its wonderful flavor.
So when we all go to the grocery store and buy a spice, you know, we may be thinking, why is this so expensive? I mean, a lot of spices are very expensive if you weigh them out by weight. You know, the amount that you're paying for a couple of ounces of spice, you know, per pound, it's, you know, $20, $30, $100.
There's no doubt about that. And it's one of the questions that I love to get when I was working at McCormick, because what we try to do is to tell people to calculate what is the usage cost each time you put a drop of vanilla in there. And yes, the 4 ounce bottle of vanilla might cost $10, but by the time you divide it into many hundreds of uses, the actual use for any spice that you use that gives the recipe its flavor, after all, is measured in just pennies. So you can have a lot of money for the meat, and you can have for the potatoes and the vegetables, but the spices are costing just a couple pennies and getting most of the flavor benefit.
Okay, but I can go to the store and look at one company's row of spices and another company, and one company's spices may be twice as expensive. So is it really great marketing and a beautiful jar that I'm paying for? Or is there a discernible difference actually in the spices, and where does that come from?
I think it's pretty much marketing. I think there's no doubt about it. Spice Island always had this cachet of, you know, being really special. McCormick was sort of the one that everybody knew. It's the largest spice company. It's a $4 billion corporation, so they're the biggest in the world. The result is that you get probably a better quality product out of there. It's a cleaner, more uniform, higher quality spice out of McCormick than you would get from some of the smaller people that maybe do a better job of marketing on a small scale.
All right, though, we should say you're biased. I mean, you're a company man. You worked at McCormick for more than 30 years.
I guess I should say I am a McCormick stockholder, but that's not the reason I say that.
But, I mean, there's no difference, really, if I'm buying in bulk from a company that might give me a really big plastic bottle of cumin, and I can get that for the same price as a smaller jar of cumin. The cumin is actually the same that I'm getting from most companies.
It should be pretty much. Yeah, a lot of these spices are pretty much commodities, and you're getting cumin seed that comes out of India. It's the same one that everybody's getting. Now, McCormick has its own operations in India. It's cleaning it. It's sterilizing it. Maybe some of the other smaller companies don't clean or even sterilize the spices. So there are a lot of risk in buying from the smaller producers.
Let's just touch on that while you've brought up this idea of sterilization and cleaning. Because there was a report that came out late last year about contamination in spices. And I can't remember now whether they said 7% or 12% of all spices that are sold here are contaminated with insect or rodent hairs or body parts. And there was a spice buyer a few years ago who got in trouble. I think he got fired for saying, you know, that's just part of the trade. You know, that's the way it is. It's a little bit reminiscent of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. You think about your meat, you're going to have a few mice in your meat. But in spices, is it just something that comes along with the trade? You're already retired, so I can't get you fired.
Yeah, I'm retired. I can't be fired. Like my predecessor was at McCormick. He's the one you were talking about. In agricultural products, in every agricultural products that we eat, there are fragments of those insects that live out in the fields. There's no doubt about it. And that was one of the things that McCormick, being so big, and one of my jobs was to go back to the countries where these spices came from, work with the farmers, set up our own processing plants to try to minimize that. Whether you eat peanut butter or a loaf of bread, any agricultural product is going to have microscopic insect fragments and other contaminants in there.
So that's just something we should live with. We should understand and live with.
And especially here in Vermont, where we're using, you know, farm to market. If you go down to some of the food shops here, especially some of the produce items, and look under a microscope, there would be things that might surprise you.
And in fact, some cultures eat a lot of insects, so maybe it's not such a bad thing anyway.
Well, my boss many years ago got fired by remarking that the insect fragments, after all, were protein, and protein was good for you.
We're talking today about spices. We're speaking with Hank Kastner, who was a spice buyer for more than 30 years, and he can answer your questions about the spices on your spice rack or in your cupboard. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Tell us your favorite spice at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. And let's go to Ward, who's calling in from Brandon. Hi, Ward. Go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I've just had a general question concerning paprika. I noticed there's a tremendous amount of varieties and different uses for paprika, from cosmetic right to flavorful in some recipes. I'm wondering if he could give us a brief description of the range and uses of the different paprikas.
Ward, thanks for the question. That's a good one, because paprika does sometimes kind of seem like something that you just put on top of deviled eggs for color.
Exactly.
Or you can have chicken paprikash, which is that wonderful paprika flavor. So yeah, what Ward's saying, what are the ranges and flavors of paprika?
Paprika primarily for color. The Hungarian paprika is probably best known for its spicy note. What people don't realize is that paprika is a species called Capsicum annuum, which is the species of red pepper. It's nothing but red pepper that's been bred in certain climates over years, in Spain and other more temperate climates away from the tropics, where red peppers are more familiar. And over time, that level of capsaicin, the heat component in the red peppers, has been bred out. So you end up with a red pepper without any heat, and that's what paprika is. So again, primarily for its color. Red peppers are very high in vitamin C and some of the health aspects of spices, besides the flavor aspects that we're familiar with. But some of the health aspects are very, very important. And certainly paprika, with its high vitamin C content, can be included in that group.
So if you're looking for a particularly flavorful paprika, what should you be looking for?
Well, certainly, again, the Hungarian paprika, by virtue of the fact that it has some of that capsaicin left in it, and you get a little bit of that spicy note, gives you a little bit more flavor than the Spanish paprika or the domestic California paprika that we're used to.
We got a note going back to vanilla from Lynette, who says, my friend brought me vanilla pods back from Madagascar, and I don't know how to store them. Also, how long will the pods last, and do they spoil after a while? How would I know?
Oh, that's a good question. Vanilla is one of the spices that actually improves with storage. The vanilla beans that I showed you earlier, Jane, were probably 15 years old.
No kidding.
And they will continue to improve. A vanilla extract that you'll have in your cupboard improves with age. So if you have some old vanilla extract, it's actually better than the others. So There's no doubt about that.
So there's no way, Lynette shouldn't be worried that her vanilla pods are going to spoil.
The vanilla pods, if stored properly and airtight, is pretty good, but you might want to take the top off once in a while. If you see any white mold or something that would grow on there, obviously that would be a problem. Actually, vanillin, the chemical that's in there that gives vanilla most of its flavor, inhibits mold growth and keeps it from spoiling. So you can keep it for a very long time, either in the bean or the extract form.
Okay, and so storing it in an airtight container is the way to go.
Yeah, in a glass jar, maybe with a cap on it.
So if the pods get nice and hard, that's okay. You can still use them?
If they're in there, they probably won't lose moisture and they won't be that hard. But the hard is just simply the moisture disappearing and the flavor components should be left behind.
Okay, so you can still use a hard vanilla pod if you've kept it in
exactly.
a non-airtight.
Even one that would break like a twig, that would be okay.
We got a note from Dennis who says, are there any spices that, because of where they come from, might be the culinary equivalent of blood diamonds?
I can't think of anything right now. Over time, there have been changes in origin. We used to get cumin seed, for example, from Iran. And when we stopped dealing with Iran, we couldn't get it, so we had to get it somewhere else. I remember when Saigon cinnamon from South Vietnam was the high-quality gourmet cinnamon that McCormick had in its gourmet line. And after the Vietnam War, there was a 25-year period when we couldn't get that, so we had to go elsewhere for our high-quality cinnamon. But I can't think of any that are coming from African countries where it would be sort of the blood diamond kind of a story.
Yeah, and I mean, what you're talking about there are sort of geopolitics and U.S.
exactly.
trade relations, but are there, I mean, we know in the history of the world that spices have launched explorations, and they must have also then been involved in wars and conflicts around the world.
Can you go back
in time a little bit?
Oh my goodness, we need more than the time of this show to talk about the history of spices. One of my favorite things, I do have a slideshow that I do on the history of spices that's fantastic, but the best quick example of that is the Dutch and the British fought over a monopoly of the nutmeg market in eastern Indonesia. And the Dutch had all the islands where nutmegs are produced except one called Run Island. The British had that. And there was a war and a battle, and finally a treaty in 1667 called the Treaty of Breda, where the British gave up the island of Run in Indonesia to the Dutch so that they would have a complete monopoly. And they gave, in response to that, an island that they had in the Western Hemisphere, actually in North America, that they didn't have any interest in, called New Amsterdam, which of course is New York City, Manhattan Island. So that was a sort of an interesting story about the history of spices.
And so nutmeg, should you buy that in nut form and grind it yourself, or is it okay to buy pre-ground nutmeg?
No doubt about it. Any spice that you can have in the whole form and grind it at home, whether it's peppercorns or nutmegs, certainly the best way to do that, because whole spices can be kept for 50 or 100 years. Ground spices, depending on how you store them, and a lot of people have them in a glass jar over their stove so it's hot and it's getting direct sunlight. McCormick loves that. Her spice companies love that. Because you're going
to
have to replace it every 3 or 5 years. You're going to have to replace those ground spices.
Or what? Do they just lose their flavor? I mean,
they simply lose their flavor. Ground cinnamon ends up being just like sawdust. And I've been in many people's homes and they are showing off their spices to me because they know I'm a spice man. I say, oh, look, this is cinnamon that my mother gave me when I got married. And I said, well, have you ever tasted it? And we put it out, pour it in their hand and put their finger in it and taste it. And there's no flavor, you know, so you're just fooling yourself to think you can keep ground spices for a long period of time.
Herbs also,
it's very difficult.
Nobody's going to invite you over now that they know.
No,
that
I'm very difficult. My wife reminds me of that.
Let's go to Allie calling in from Stowe. Hi, Allie. Go ahead.
Hi. I like to use the white pepper versus the black pepper, but I don't get the flavor and the taste, the pungent of the black pepper. Why is that?
That's an interesting story. Black pepper, white pepper, and green peppercorns come from the same vine. They're the same agricultural product. Green peppercorns are harvested when they're green and put into a brine solution, and we put them in certain recipes. If the peppercorn goes to maturity and the red coating that is there at maturity sloughs off when it's soaked in water, the kernel of the pepper is actually the white pepper. So white pepper is the kernel and has very much flavor with the black pepper. Black pepper is the green peppercorn that's sun-dried, and that outer carapace stays on there with a lot of the flavor components in. So white pepper is a much milder flavor of pepper. The British like that. If you go to England and have pepper, they like white pepper. They just don't have very much excitement in their cuisine.
Uh-oh.
Of course, I've said that in front of English people, and I get a lot of people that disagree, but
Well, and how can you say that given that one of the national dishes of Great Britain now is curry?
Yeah, that's because, of course, the immigrant population has nothing to do with the British themselves. Although I guess, of course, the immigrant population today is included in that, and they're British. But
well, and you go to any pub in Great Britain, and you're going to find a curry on the menu.
Yeah,
so it's infused in the culture.
My best Indian meal was in London, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, we are talking today about spices. Curry, boy, there's a whole plethora of spices we could get into. But listeners, if you have a question for Hank Kastner about some spice that's on your mind, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or post. Tell us your favorite spices. Give us a recipe if you want. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking spices with Shelburne resident Hank Kastner, who was a spice buyer for McCormick & Company, the world's largest spice company. It was a lifelong career for him. He is retired now, but still works as a consultant and helps counties, countries, companies figure out spice contracts and other things that involve this kind of global food trade. If you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Putney. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about cinnamon. It seems that what I've heard lately is that most of the cinnamon we now get is called cassia. It's actually not the same thing as cinnamon bark, which has gotten really expensive. Is that true?
No, it's actually not true. Cinnamon and cassia are two different species. Cinnamomum is the genus. There are about four different species of cinnamomum tree.
Cinnamomum
is the genus name, and the species name for the one that's in China is Cinnamomum cassia. And that one is used primarily in the pharmaceutical trade. The Chinese pay extra because they think it has medicinal properties. For 5,000 years, traditional Chinese medicine has used cassia. In the United States, we use a species that comes from Indonesia, and that is not cassia. It is an Asiatic one, and it's different than true cinnamon. I think part of the confusion is that there is a true cinnamon called Cinnamomum verum, not surprisingly the Latin word for true, that comes from Sri Lanka. And that's used primarily in the British Isles. Again, they like a milder flavored spice. And in Latin America, it's hardly ever used here in the United States. So the one that we use from Indonesia, by virtue of the fact that it's very different than true cinnamon, it's one of the Asiatic cinnamons. A lot of people say that that's a cassia cinnamon, but it is not actually the species Cinnamomum cassia that comes from China.
Huh. Well, on that, maybe this is similar. I'm not sure. Kate wrote in to say, some years ago, the commercial cinnamon flavoring began to seem overbearing to me. So I did some research and I found that what is often now sold as cinnamon is now the bark of a similar tree. So it sounds like a similar question to what we were just hearing from Tim. But she says, I now use Ceylon cinnamon, which comes from a limited area of the world, and I'm told it's a layer under the bark, perhaps the cambium. Would you make this distinction, or is the harsh flavor of mass-market cinnamon due to other reasons?
Certainly the true cinnamon, the one you're talking about from Sri Lanka, Cinnamomum verum, it comes from smaller trees. The bark is much thinner, and it is that inner layer of the bark, the cambium, that has most of the cinnamic aldehyde, which is where the flavor comes from. Today in the United States, I would guess that 99% comes from the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. It's a species called Cinnamomum burmani. It's closest to Cinnamomum cassia. It's closest to the cassia flavor. Certainly very different than the true cinnamon. But it's so very rare to find true cinnamon in the market here that most people are not aware of it.
Would you notice the difference if you put some on your tongue and taste it?
Oh, my goodness. If you remember as a child, and some of the listeners may, juicy fruit chewing gum. I mean, it's a very, very fruity flavor that comes out of the true cinnamon from Sri Lanka. Very different than the harsh or stronger flavor that comes out of the Indonesian or the Chinese cinnamons.
Huh. Let's go to Ralph calling in from Eastbury. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you today?
Great.
I have kind of a twofold question. And one is organic versus non-organic spices. My concern is that, you know, how heavily sprayed might they be? And the second part of the question is there any parts of the globe that I should be cautious about getting spice from?
Most of the spices come from very, very primitive parts of the world. I'm thinking of vanilla from Madagascar. The farmers there don't have the economic ability to buy pesticides, even if they wanted to. And I've set up organic vanilla processes in Madagascar in order to get the label that it's organic. But it doesn't require telling the farmers not to use pesticides because they don't anyway. The farmers up on Mount Kerinci in Sumatra and Indonesia, where the cinnamon grows, also don't use pesticides. So for most of the typical spices, traditional spices, ginger, turmeric, cinnamon, black pepper, pesticides are not used. Now, you can get organic and you can have the proof that that's the case, but in almost every instance, you wouldn't have to worry about that at all. The only thing to worry about, I would think, would be on some of the herb items, things like parsley that might come out of California, where pesticides are used in large quantities. Some of the herbs, I think you'd have to be careful, and that would certainly be worth paying a premium for organic in those cases, because you would be saving yourself from exposure to those chemicals.
Hank, what's the actual difference between an herb and a spice? What's the definition of a spice?
Spice is a dehydrated plant part that imparts flavor to the culinary product. The herbs are primarily leafy. They do the same thing. They're in the dried form, and I sort of put them in the same category as spices. But we have spices, the true traditional spices, again, the pepper, the cinnamon, the turmeric. We have seeds, the cumin seed and coriander seed and some of the rest of them. And then you have the herbs. So you can divide it into three categories or just call them all spices.
So we have things like ginger. That's a root. That would be considered a spice. Right. What about garlic? Is that considered a vegetable, a spice?
Garlic and onion really in the spice trade aren't considered spices, whether they're vegetables, but they're sold by the spice companies. And under the definition of a botanical, a dried botanical that can be used for flavoring, certainly they fit into that in some instances.
Why did you want to get started in this career? And then, I mean, clearly it was something that you liked enough to stick with it.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult in the early days because it meant in McCormick, we started traveling overseas, and I had a very supportive wife because I would be gone for 2 or 3 weeks. And in those days, you were out of contact. There weren't cell phones and things to keep in touch with. So if you went to Madagascar or Indonesia for 2 or 3 weeks, there was no way to get in touch with you. So my wife was very supportive and allowed me to do that. I love to travel. I love languages. I love cultures. I love experiences. My hobby is bird watching. I might as well say that on the weekends when I was in Indonesia and Madagascar, to be able to go out into the jungle and see the birds and the animals and have that experience was also very, very important to me. But because I like to travel, I did a lot, and certainly it benefited McCormick in a very big way because I was able to accomplish things on improving the quality, on knowing whether the prices were likely to go up or down, and saving money that way.
Well, and you've said that you saved McCormick, what, $100 million, did you say?
It's many tens of millions of dollars, depending on how you determine what a savings is. But by knowing that a shortage was coming and taking a long 3-year position of vanilla toward the end of my career, or setting up a cleaning factory in Indonesia that cleaned cinnamon, that meant we didn't have to spend 10 cents a pound to clean the cinnamon when it arrived in the United States. If you add all those things up, it was close to $100 million.
So what do you think, Hank, about the locavore movement now and the idea that we should be preserving communities that are growing food near us and saving food miles, watching our carbon footprint? I mean, certainly when we talk about a lot of spices, those are not things that you're going to be able to get locally.
No, that's certainly true. With the exception of the herbs, I think your comment is certainly correct. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. There are both sides of these arguments. Just reading in the paper, the Burlington Free Press knows in the 7 days today about the argument about wind power versus natural gas and all these different things. There are different sides, and none of these things are black and white.
So you're going to stay out of that debate.
I'm going to stay out of that one. That's right.
Let's go to Pamela calling in from Tunbridge. Hi, Pamela. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm from Tunbridge, as you said, and I really would like to disagree with you, if I may, about one generalization, which is that British food isn't exciting. I personally think that most American restaurant food is very overspiced, and they do it because the food isn't really fresh and or of high quality. And I think that when you do cook, I mean, I love spices, but it really depends on the culture of the cuisine, and also as well as the quality and freshness of the food. I cook a lot of French and Italian food, and you don't use a lot of spices. You do not use a lot of strong pepper, and it's delicious food.
Yeah, Pamela, I hear what you're saying. I'm going to put that to Hank, because certainly spices can be used to over flavor when you're missing the flavor of the natural goodness of the food. Do you find spices, how do you cook with them to make sure you're not masking flavor but enhancing it?
Well, I'm lucky. I married a woman who's an excellent cook, and I haven't had to be a cook in my 45 years of marriage, so I can't answer that specifically. I don't know. I'm sort of caught without words.
Every time
I make the mistake of talking about British cooking, I wish I hadn't said
that's
it.
Right.
That maybe that's the category I'm in again today.
Well, except but Pamela's saying it's actually the cuisine here that she's complaining about, that it sometimes seems overspiced. I mean, do you think that that's a worry that people just sort of, I mean, I will admit, I dump cumin in food because I love the flavor of cumin, but perhaps I should just eat the cumin and save the rest of
Red pepper is another thing. I mean, my wife will go out and say, oh, is there too much pepper in this? I don't want to order that. So yeah, you can't please everybody all the time. We have in the United States a wonderful combination of many different cuisines, the French and the Italian and the Mexican, and you could go on and on, Korean. So they're different flavors, and they're not going to be appropriate for everybody's palate. Some people are going to like them, and some people are not going to like them. I'm sure there are people that put extra spices in because that's where the flavor is, maybe to hide poor quality raw material that goes into some of the other components of the meal. That's very possible.
Let's go to Bill in Rutland. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hello. I have a question historically, and that is when historically they're referring to the Spice Road and the Spice Islands, what are they specifically referring to?
The Spice Road is primarily the trafficking of spices that came across through Central Asia up into 1453 when 1453 was the fall of Constantinople, and the spice trade that came from India and China overland into Europe was stopped at that time. Then we went to the oceans, and Vasco da Gama and Columbus found sea routes to where the spices came from. So the spice route actually became a water route rather than an overland route at that point in time.
So we've got Spice Islands, Spice Road. Do you find other places that are named after the spices in the world?
Places named after the spices. I'm not sure of that, but one of my favorite stories was when I was a child, we were told to be afraid of the boogeyman. And it turns out that the boogies were pirates that lived in eastern Indonesia that attacked the Dutch trading ships that were bringing the cloves and the nutmegs back into Jakarta for transshipment to Europe. And the pirates or the pilots of the boats or the captains of the boats would warn each other, watch out for the boogies, watch out for the boogies. So that's where our expression boogeyman came from.
Hank, you had this career as a spice buyer for more than three decades, and here you are on the show trying to tell us about spices, teach us about where they came from. Why is that piece important to you, and what do you want to get across to people about the spices that we just buy at the store?
I think it's so fascinating. The spice industry, the profession, is the second oldest profession in the world. We go back about 7,000 years in terms of written records, whether it's Chinese medicine or Indian medicine. Hippocrates, 500 BC, was the father of modern medicine, and he talked about many, many spices that were used for medicinal purposes. So there's history, there's medicine, there's flavor, there's intrigue. I had lunch one time with the king of Tonga. I met a king. All sorts of adventures as I was traveling around the world. It's been the most entertaining and educational job that I could have possibly had.
Well, and we talked briefly at the top of the show and a little bit here with some questions about cinnamon and the bark of the tree, and you're not sure that most people even know that that's where cinnamon comes from.
Oh, I hope I have time for this last story because it's my favorite one. Many, many years ago, I came back from Indonesia, and I'd taken some pictures of farmers stripping the bark off the cinnamon trees, and it was a McCormick Christmas party, and one of the McCormick vice presidents came up to me, and instead of saying, "Hi, Hank, what are you doing for Christmas?" he said, "Oh, Hank, I understand you've been traveling. What spices have you seen?" And I said, "Well, I was just in Indonesia and watching the farmers strip the bark off the cinnamon trees." And he said, "What? Cinnamon is the bark of a tree?" And I went home that night and told my wife. My wife is much smarter than I. And she said to me, "Well, how are they going to know if you don't tell them?" So I began to take these slides and pictures that I was taking, put them into a slideshow. My first audience was the board of directors of McCormick. And it was fascinating to see the expression on their faces as they learned for the first time that their third most important raw material, cinnamon, was in fact the bark of a tree that was coming from primarily one volcano in western Sumatra, Indonesia. So beginning with that time, the education of people about spices has been so important to me, and I've gotten so much joy from doing that,
I
am today.
Now we have to wait for your book to come out, right?
That's right. That's my next project. People say, "What are you going to do next?" And with all those pictures and all the stories, I think a book called Spices, What Are They? Where Do They Come From? is overdue at this point.
All right. Well, send it to us when you get
I'll
it published.
I'll do that.
Shelburne resident Hank Kastner was a spice buyer for McCormick & Company for 33 years. He now consults for spice companies. Hank, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a new company gets started in the old Ethan Allen Furniture Factory in the Northeast Kingdom. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2000, the Northeast Kingdom town of Brighton was hit hard when the local Ethan Allen Furniture Factory shut down. It left more than 100 people out of work. 14 years later, this factory is finally being repurposed. A Connecticut-based maple syrup company has bought the property, bringing with it the promise of new jobs. Joel Cope, administrative assistant for the town of Brighton, joins us now. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So just give us a sense of how much of a hole the closing of the Ethan Allen factory left in the town of Brighton.
Well, it was a pretty big one. A lot of our people who were on our ambulance squad and our fire department worked at that factory, and the company was very gracious in allowing those people, when there was an emergency, to take off from work and respond. And when they left, a lot of those people had to find employment elsewhere, and we suffered on our emergency services, not to mention the economy of the town took a big hit.
And it's remained closed for the last 14 years?
That's correct.
So what does it mean, then, to have a new company in to buy it? I understand the company is called Sweet Tree Holdings. It's based in Connecticut. It's purchased the factory, and it's purchased, what, 3,000 acres of land in the area?
Right. 3,200 acres, I believe, up in Avery's Gore, which is part of the Unified Towns and Gores.
Uh-huh. Go on. So it's purchased it. What do we know about Sweet Tree Holdings?
What do we know about them? Well, not a lot. A fellow came into the office one day here and said that he represented them, and they were part of a larger organization called Wood Creek Capital, which was owned or operated by five pension funds that were operated by Massachusetts Mutual, and they were looking for a good investment. And I guess that means that maple syrup production in Vermont is a good investment. I think it's gone global. I think much of the product that they make, is my understanding, may be shipped overseas to meet the growing demand for the market overseas.
And the land that they bought, the 3,200 acres, that's maple groves, so they're planning to actually tap the maples in the area and make the maple syrup in Brighton?
Well, the land's not in Brighton, but it's not far away. They will set up ROs, reverse osmosis units, for which I guess they're large enough that they had to get a zoning permit for those from the Unified Towns and Gores. They'll set up their ROs on site, collect the sap by tubing, go through the reverse osmosis process to get to the point where the sap is 20% rather than, say, the normal 1 to 2% that might come out of an uncultivated sugar bush. They'll transport that 20% sap down. It's 20% sugar is what we're talking about instead of 1 or 2% sugar. When sap comes out of a tree, it's mostly just like water.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll transport that down to the plant and process it at the plant.
And what's the timeline for this to get it all up and running?
I think they're aiming for next year. They've got people, contractors at the site right now, and they're getting the old plant refurbished. And I guess the plant was built in the time when heating and fuel prices were not a big issue. So they had designed it to melt the snow on the roof by not putting any insulation in the ceiling, is what I recall. So they've got to insulate the plant and get it ready for this new operation.
Joel, how many jobs are they promising?
They're not really promising anything. They're talking about 21 jobs. I'm not sure where those jobs are going to come from at this point.
So 21 jobs doesn't fill the hole created by the more than 100 jobs that the Ethan Allen factory provided to residents. But you think this is a good fit for the town?
We're not complaining.
Go ahead.
And this is the second large maple producer from out of town to come into town. Another company from Canada bought a plant when the woodworking plant went out in 2000-2001. A group of those workers decided to have an employee-owned organization, and Bobby Miller, a very gracious developer, built them a plant and held the paper for them on that while they tried to keep their jobs. And they employed 40 or 50 people for a while, for 5 years, and then they went belly up, and that building is now occupied by another maple company that wants to tap 50,000 or more trees as well, but they want to do it by having agreements with existing landowners that have their own trees. They're not apparently buying property. That's my understanding at this point.
Well, so perhaps seeing a little bit of a business trend, maple syrup producers coming into the Northeast Kingdom, certainly seeing the factory, the old Ethan Allen factory, reopened and that space repurposed will be a good thing for the town. Joel Cope is the administrative assistant for Brighton. He's been telling us about that old furniture company factory that's been purchased by a Connecticut-based maple syrup company. Joel, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Boy, it's all food all the time today on the show. If you've ever made iced coffee, your efforts may have involved pouring piping hot brew over ice cubes that immediately melt, or maybe you just stick your leftover hot coffee in the fridge. Well, there's another method you can use, and for this week's summer school, we're going to get an education in cold brew coffee. It's perfect for the summer because you don't actually even need to boil water, but you do need a bit of patience. VPR's Angela Evansy went after hours to Maglianero Cafe in Burlington to get a lesson in at-home cold brewing.
My name is Abby Holden. I work at Maglianero Cafe in Burlington, Vermont. We are making cold brew iced coffee. Cold brew is just one method of making iced coffee, which involves pouring room temperature water over coarsely ground coffee and letting it sit for 12 to 14 hours. And what you get at the end is a concentrate that you can then dilute and add ice, and you got iced coffee. It's not necessarily better. It's just a different kind of method. People tend to think that cold brew iced coffee is less acidic. Okay, so if you have a French press, that's pretty much the best way to do it. If you don't have a French press, you can just use a jar. We will be weighing out 110 grams of coffee and grinding it very coarse, kind of like a French press grind. If you don't have a scale, 110 grams would be roughly 16 tablespoons of ground coffee. Now we are going to pour the ground coffee into the bottom of the French press and start pouring water over it. And here we go. So we are going to pour 875 grams of room temperature water. 875 grams is roughly 32 ounces of water. I like to enjoy my cold brew coffee just black as it is. It has a really kind of smooth creaminess. So, if you do have a French press, put the cover on top of the French press, but don't press it. Just leave the filter resting on top of the grounds. If you're doing it in a jar, you can just loosely cover the jar. So, this is called cold brew coffee, but in reality, it's more just like room temperature brewed coffee because we don't put it in the fridge. We just leave it out on the counter. If it was in the fridge, it would be too cold for most of the compounds to extract from the ground coffee, and it would probably taste pretty weak. So, after 12 to 14 hours have elapsed, lightly press the coffee, if you have a French press, and pour out the concentrate into a different container. So, if you do have a French press, the concentrate will tend to be a little bit silty, so We suggest that you might want to strain it through a thin cloth. If you're brewing it in a jar, you could just pour the coffee after the time has elapsed through a piece of cloth in general. If you've done it right, it should look pretty thick and dark because you are going to dilute it. So the way we suggest you dilute it with this recipe would be half concentrate and half water, and then you just add ice and you'd have iced coffee. The cold brew tends to taste fairly good with cream and sugar, but we would totally suggest just drinking it black. It's very refreshing.
That was Abby Holden, a barista at Maglianero Cafe in Burlington. VPR's Angela Evansy produced that piece. And to see a step-by-step recipe with photos for making your own cold brew coffee, not old, we like it fresh, own cold brew coffee, go to vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about boating on Lake Champlain. Lake Champlain is, of course, the sixth largest lake in the nation. It has its own culture, and we're going to explore how people adventure on the lake by boat. From tourists motoring down from Quebec to the avid competitors who race their sailboats on summer weekends, there are ferries and kayaks. We're even going to find out how you can get into boating if you don't have a boat of your own. So turn up the radio if you're going to be out on the water yourself and tune in tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.